This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, obviously from much earlier in the history of that genre, and a group that worked out of Chicago. That recording is more than a century old. It reflects a moment in jazz history. The song you just heard, Chimes Blues, includes the first recorded solo of a man who would become a music legend, Louis Armstrong. A lot of the recordings from this era have been lost or forgotten, but there's a record label based out of Champaign that is working to change that. Archaeophone Records got its start more than a quarter century ago. Its aim is to preserve and restore historic recordings dating from the 1920s on the near end and as far back as around 1890. The label's gotten a couple dozen Grammy nominations over the year, with one win in 2006 for Best Historical Album. And in the last few weeks, Archaeophone got three more Grammy nominations for its work, including for the box set with the restored recording you just heard. Here to talk about all of that are the label's co-founders, husband and wife Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy. Rich, Megan, congratulations on the latest nominations. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
So the track is on a box set called Centennial. Talk about the history behind that.
Behind the set?
Yeah, sure. Or the song. Take it where you will.
The recordings of the King Oliver Band that were made in 1923 have long been regarded as some of the most seminal jazz recordings in the genre's history. It's really the time where, you know, jazz starts to take shape on record. It's not jazz like we think of it now with all these improvised solos. It's really more about polyphony and section playing. They've been put out before. People have heard them before, but never all in one place quite like we've done it, and never with the quality of sound like we've got it. They're very sought-after records. From 1923, like I said, and the price that they're realized in auctions is typically very high, much beyond our means. So we are lucky to have partnered with a number of top drawer collectors from all over America and Europe to get the best copies and restore them for this set.
Why is music from this era so forgotten or maybe so hard to come by?
I think the answer on that depends on what the recordings are and what the time period is. In the case of these records, you know, not necessarily a lot of them were made at the time. And when you go back to the earlier period we worked with, early into the 1890s, mass production wasn't a thing for records. And so people would go into a studio and record, and maybe you get six copies, and then they would do that again and again and again. And before mass production, there just aren't as many records out there, and they're hard to find. They didn't necessarily survive. They were very fragile, too, particularly the stuff from the 90s.
And the other reason is the sound. Prior to the days of microphones showing up in the studios in 1925, the performers had to gather around a horn and shout if they're singing, or play their instruments right into the bell of the horn. And the recordings were made by mechanical means only. It's the force of the sound waves through the funnel-like horn, all centered on a sensitive diaphragm that then vibrated a needle and cut sound waves into wax. And that's what you're hearing.
Kind of like the opposite of the phonograph, just, you know, where the people know the RCA logo, right, with the dog leaning its ear into the horn. You're sort of playing the sound in reverse in that situation,
I guess,
to do the recording itself.
Yeah. Right. It's in fact, you know, if you had a cylinder phonograph, you could do both. You could cut a record and then change out the cutter for a reproducer and play it back at home. It's a wonderful invention. People, you know, flock to it. But today, you know, it's regarded, I think, by some as being primitive, or they think the sound is a little funny, and you know, doesn't have crystal clear CD style audio, and so I think that is a stumbling block for some people.
Yeah, well, let's get another example of it. We're going to take a break, and we will listen to another track that Archaeophone has restored. This is from an earlier project called Waxing the Gospel. This is the Hallelujah Chorus, as recorded by Baldwin's Cadet Band of Boston all the way back in the mid-1890s. We want to hear from you. What do you appreciate about this, both the recording, this work? We're going to take a listen. You can join us at 800-222-9455, and we will have more with Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy, co-founders and co-owners of Archaeophone Records in Champaign, Illinois. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is The Dancing Deacon by Dabney's Band, a recording from 1919. It's recordings like that that are the bread and butter of Archaeophone Records, a label based in Champaign that focuses on preserving and restoring historic recordings. We're talking about this with the co-founders and co-owners, husband and wife duo Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy. Archaeophone's work has just gotten 3 Grammy nominations in the past few weeks. We're going to talk about that too. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. All right, what made you both want to get into preserving this music?
So we both grew up listening to pop music and following the Billboard charts, and at some point started to wonder what happened before rock and roll, and read and realized there was this enormous universe of material that had been kind of forgotten and overlooked. There were a few big names that people would remember, but a lot of the artists, a lot of the repertoire, a lot of the sound was just written out of history, not included. And we thought, there's a big story here to be told, and we wanted to tell it with research and illustrations and try to bring it to life.
I want to talk a little about your process, and maybe we can do that by way of example. We're going to listen to another track from that set, Centennial, that we talked about at the beginning. This is called The Fatal Stone from the opera Aida, as recorded by trombonist Arthur Pryor and cornet player Emil Kenneke. Rich and Megan, talk about how that came to you and how it is now and how you got it from point A to point B.
Ah, okay. Well, that's a 1909 disc record, Victor record from 1909. And, you know, the boring behind-the-scenes work is you need a clean copy of the record. You need to physically clean it, right, get all the dirt out of it. You need to have a a good system, a good turntable. You need to center the record. You need to choose the right stylus to fit the groove so that you can minimize noise that way. Get a stereo transfer, even though it's a mono recording, because in the restoration sphere, one side of the groove is more damaged than the other. You can have options. And you get a good digital high-res transfer of it. And from there, ingest it into the digital audio workstation, the DAW, as some people call it. And from there, I, you know, do things like declicking, you know, a variety of means of noise reduction, and then some sort of surgical type sculpting, I guess you'd say, of where I go through the signal microsecond by microsecond to clean up little areas that are, you know, infelicitous. And then you do the EQing and mastering, which once you have all the other tracks, the mastering is when you sort of put it all together and make it fit together. That's,
you know, and,
how it goes.
And I can sort of picture what you're describing, because working in sound ourselves and radio, I have some experience with digital audio workstations, although I think probably not to the level of particularity that you have to bring to these projects. But maybe for people who aren't familiar with that, you know, when you make a digital recording of a sound file, it's really a bunch of ones and zeros. It's sort of a chart. You can picture a piece of graph paper where you have the low sounds on the bottom, the high sounds on the top, and it's time as you go from left to right. And you can just really zoom in, or when you say you're sculpting it, you're making little minute changes and you know, say the 8,000 kilohertz frequency at, you know, 14.332 on this recording or something like that.
Yeah, the big advance over the last 20 years or so, maybe not quite that long, is the prevalence now of spectrographic based software programs. So what you're referring to is dead accurate. I mean, in terms of what, you know, we've had to work with for decades, but now you can, you know, the program is called Isotope RX, you know, like pharmacy RX fixing
yeah.
the signal. And with the heat map of spectrography, what you get is time on the x-axis, but frequency on the vertical, and amplitude is signified by the severity the intensity, I should say, of the light on the pattern. And with that, now you can just go to, like you say, 8,000 hertz and fix that little blip that's there. Whereas before, with regular audio editors, any change you make to the signal at any point in time affects zero all the way up to 22,000 hertz.
Yeah.
With the spectrographic, you can go in and just target a tiny part.
All right, I love this. I'm nerding out here. I'm worried we may lose some of our listeners. So
it's always a risk.
Yeah. All right. So that's the sort of the sound file, the actual acoustic aspect of what you do. The other thing is the history behind this music. How do you integrate that context into your work?
Well, every reissue we've done has substantial album notes. I think the smallest booklet we've ever included is 12 pages, and that was, I think that's only one of those. And so in the case of the Centennial Box Set, for example, which is nominated for historical album and album notes, we've got an 80-page hardback book. And so we...
But it's a 12-by-12
12-by-12, yeah, 80-page 12-by-12 book. And so we do research. Sometimes we hire writers who are experts on the artists or the material we're covering. But our goal is to, we talk about the records, we talk about the history. We try really, really hard to make them real and to offer insight so that there's something other than kind of a quaint old record.
Yeah, this is not a nostalgia business. We're not interested in, you know, the hits that your grandparents listened to, except that, you know, we want to talk about the times that your grandparents lived in, you know, and what that meant for the music, the recordings, the performers, etc.
You know, I think when people hear this music today, unless they are a collector or a scholar or somebody very history minded, you know, they maybe picture a Buster Keaton short or something like that. Some of the you know, the jazzier ragtime music. It's black and white. It has that sort of the same feeling we maybe feel, you know, the video that seems a little speeded up because of right. the way the cameras worked and the way we look at it now. I'm trying to think of how to ask this to you. When you hear this music, when you think about it, are you hearing it in that sort of old-timey black and white way, or does it somehow become more, you know, in color to you?
It's very alive to us. I mean, we, like I said, the sound takes some getting used to for a newbie, but once you get it, there's no other kind of sound like this. In fact, the piece you just played by Pryor and Kenneke of the aria from Aida, that's on Centennial because along with our writer Ricky Riccardi, who's the expert on Louis Armstrong, he's the research director at the Louis Armstrong House in Corona, Queens, New York. We put together a CD of records that Louis Armstrong himself actually owned, or that he was very fond of, or that he knew about, because what he was doing in the late 19-teens, and then really all the way till he died, was he was constantly collecting records and studying the tone, and what he called it tonation. We might say tonality, but he loved that sound, and he was trying to imitate it. So when you hear these sui generis, you know, records of the earliest jazz recordings, bear in mind, the guy making the record wanted to sound like your phonograph. He wanted to channel that sound and perfect it.
And just to add on to what Rich said, the longer you listen, the more you recognize the craft of engineering in the oldest days. You talked about the recording horn process in the last section. You know, everything was recorded live. It was one take. They couldn't go in and redo it, and the artistry and the staging needed to make sure everybody was heard and everything sounded optimal was an art. For example, going to the first, you know, Oliver recordings, one of the challenges they had was that Louis Armstrong played loudly enough that he drowned everybody else out. So they literally made him stand at the back of the room so that they could hear the other artists. That's an art of engineering.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so we've mentioned a couple of times these Grammy nominations. There have been dozens over the years. What is that like? Are you going to parties with Taylor Swift and Paul McCartney?
There's still hope.
No, not usually.
No, well, again, Brian, since you're a nerd, you might be interested in the sort of people that are good friends of ours or people that we meet. They tend to be the production people, the engineers. And some of them are big names, but, you know, most of your listeners, you know, probably have never heard of them. So we get to meet people like that. The event itself is fine. It's fun. It's, you know, we've done it a number of times now, so there's kind of a sameness, but you got to be there in case they call your name. So we'll be heading out in February, and hopefully this will get us back to the winner's circle.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I mentioned for all these nominations, you've won once. You know, they say it's an honor to be nominated. How do you feel about that?
It's true, it is. I mean, it even if you don't win, it's an amazing feeling to and a point of pride to have your work recognized as the best by your peers. I mean, it's funny, we're talking a lot about sound, but our label has 27 nominations total, and we actually have 17 for album notes. And this year, we have two albums up against each other for notes, and we're proud to be producing that kind of serious work.
Yeah, no, it's great to be recognized that way. Megan Hennessy, Richard Martin, are co-founders and owners of Champagne's Archaeophone Records. Thank you so much for joining us, and again, congratulations and good luck.
Thanks for giving us the time. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
And we are going to leave you today with one more track off of the Grammy-nominated album After Midnight. This is Dabney's Band, and the song is called That's It. And on that note, that is it for us. this week. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And today, special thanks to Jerry Moorfield. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again next week.